This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana O'Pong in Fort Libby Denkman. If you went to the movies last year, flipped through a magazine, or scrolled through your Instagram, you probably became very familiar with one plastic icon in particular.
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Ken!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Barbie did more than rake in a whole lot of cash and inspire people to put a pop of pink in their wardrobe. It also shone a spotlight behind the camera on writer-director Greta Gerwig. But Gerwig's wild success is so far the exception in Hollywood, not the rule. Women remain dramatically underrepresented as filmmakers. According to The Celluloid Ceiling, an annual study on employment of women behind the scenes in the movie industry, only 17% of the top 250 grossing films in 2023 were directed by women, and only 6% featured the work of female cinematographers. An upcoming showcase in Bellingham is dedicated to highlighting distinct and diverse works from women filmmakers from around the world. It's called the Cascadia International Women's Film Festival, and it kicks off tomorrow. And we've rounded up a panel of Cascadia featured directors to discuss their experience as filmmakers, the projects they're excited about, and to explore what can be done to expand representation behind the camera. Joining me are Jessica Plum, a Port Townsend-based documentary director and producer. Her past documentaries focus on the environment. Her new documentary is Call of the Orcas. Maria Valdez, she's a Guatemalan-born, California-raised narrative director. Her passion is bringing human interest stories to life from the Latino perspective. Her new film is Vida. And Catherine Hardwick. She's the director of many feature films, including 13, Lords of Dogtown, and the massively popular and endearing Twilight. Jessica, Maria, Catherine, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So this is for all of you. We'll start with you, Maria, and maybe we can go down the line. I want to start out by asking you about the role of movies today in our culture. We live in an age where a story can find audiences in more ways than ever before, whether that's an 8-part streaming series or TikTok. What, in your mind, is the case for creating and watching a feature film or documentary these days?
And I think it's important to keep movies alive because it's where we find our humanity. You know, as we saw, like during the pandemic, it's where we went to. It's where we found our joy, our happiness. And it's where important stories are being told. It's where, you know, it's also documents the timeline of what's happening now. And it's also, you know, it's also comfort food for us. You know, we all work extremely hard. We, you know, we have our, you know, 9-to-5s. We have, you know, families and, you know, problems and issues. And sometimes we just want to, you know, go home and enjoy and bring joy to our lives. And I think that's what television and film does to us. It just settles us, like, you know, like a good cheeseburger. It just, you know, it's joy.
Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with what Maria said. That sounds great, except for I'll go for a veggie burger personally. But I think, you know, like we love all the fun, you know, TikTok videos and everything like that. But then there's also something about when a filmmaker, a team of filmmakers take the time to really create, build a world, which takes a lot of people to do an elevated sort of feature film where you create the sets, the buildings, the costumes, take us back in time, you know, or forward in time. So I think there's some things that you can't do very easily with a fun amateur TikTok video that you can do, which I think is what Maria was talking about too. You can be transported to another place. And you can also learn about another culture. So you can really empathize with other people that are not in your world. In a feature film, maybe you have to find the right resources, enough money to be able to really fully execute that world.
And Jessica, what about you? What do you think the case is for continuing to make and create and have audiences watch feature films and documentaries when they could just do an 8-part streaming series or watch something on Instagram.
I feel that the subjects that both of the previous speakers brought up are really important. But as a documentary filmmaker, I think I would take it a step even closer to our role in exploring our common humanity. And as a documentary filmmaker, I really relish the opportunity again and again to see the world through the eyes of another person. And sometimes, since I do a lot of wildlife and environmental filmmaking, to see the world through the eyes of someone who's even not human. And I feel like it's absolutely essential for us to build that muscle, to learn what it feels like to attempt to experience life from the viewpoint of another. And, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, I've definitely taken up issues that I'm passionate about. I really have focused on the relationship between people and place, which has led me to a lot of environmental filmmaking. And I feel like there's a role for documentary films in helping to move the needle on subjects that are vital to all of us. I know there are many ways that we're bombarded by media. You know, I'm the parent of a teenager. I know that lots and lots and lots of content floods into all of our lives all the time. Taking the time to explore a complex topic through a documentary lens, I think, is still really important. And it's an opportunity to bring voice to those who might not have had a chance to share those voices across a whole spectrum of experience. So that's why I do it. And it's not easy.
And Jessica, let's stay with you. Let's say you have the beginnings of a story you want to tell. How do you know if you should try to develop it into a movie or a limited series or something else altogether?
Well, that's a terrific question. And first, I want to say that especially with any feature-length film, whether it's documentary or a narrative, choosing to dive into that project, as I'm sure everyone else in this group would agree, is an enormous commitment move. For a documentary, it can be a really long one. You know, I'm probably best known in the Northwest for a film about the restoration of the Elwha River. That was a 4-year journey in the production and post-production phase, and that's pretty typical for a documentary film. So on the most basic level, I push myself, and I do this in writing and in other ways, to really understand why I am as profoundly drawn to a topic as I am. I also personally feel like each project is a way to like flex and grow creatively. And so I'm always looking for projects that invite me to try a new way of working with the documentary craft. But that said, as a documentary filmmaker and in a somewhat different world than the other two directors represented here, I also have to acknowledge that funding is just a constant challenge. And I'm also assessing what is the core audience for this potential piece. And quite honestly, will I be able to raise the money?
Maria, we'll go to you. How do you decide when you've got the beginnings of a story that you want to tell, if it should be developed into a movie or a limited feature or something else?
You have to have a purpose for every project that you do. What is it going to fulfill? Is it going to be something that's going to reach the audience and, you know, have an emotional impact that you want? Or is it going to be something that fulfills you inside and it's a story that you like you must tell? Because it is such a huge commitment. It's time, money, blood, sweat, and tears. And so you just can't do a project if there's no purpose to it. And for me, I always trying to find the humanity in my stories, whether they're comedy, drama, or, you know, my short is an female-led action film. It's like, what is the purpose? Why am I telling the story? It has to be something that touches people. And you know, it's not to say that, and even if it's just a creative, fun outlet, that also has a lot of value because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, people want to be, you know, to be taken into a space and feel something, even if it's just happiness and joy. They just want to feel something and transport themselves into another world. And if you're providing that and providing comfort for them, you know, that's half the battle there.
And Catherine, to you, as someone who's made feature films, how do you know whether or not to do a limited series or something else?
Well, a limited series, pretty challenging. You know, I've actually been involved in multiple attempts to get a limited series to the air or a longer series. And you know, there's only so many outlets, and all those studio heads are always losing their jobs or moving. So even when we've sold something to Amazon last year, and we sold a project to Netflix that were just awesome, the bosses in each of those divisions moved on, or they got transferred or fired or whatever. So the projects didn't go. So it's very hard. It's actually been easier, not that it's easy, for me to get a feature film made, because you don't have quite so many levels of committees, you know, the studio, the network, you know, all the notes and all the people that have to approve it. Plus you got to get a showrunner, big time showrunner. So, you know, physical challenges that we were talking about, financial, you know, time commitment. In some ways, I've been able to somehow direct 10 features, you know, and in the last whatever 20 years, I mean, amazing. Yeah. And, but some of those are independent financing. Some of them, like 13, was $1.5 million non-union. I got paid $3 for it. Yeah. So it's the same thing. Each script that you write or that you receive from another writer, you know, you figure out how much do I care about it and how much time am I willing to put into trying to get the money to make this and trying to get people on board and support it. And then you start to understand that's going to be a super challenge. That one's too hard. That this one's probably never going to get made because it's set in the future, but it's a little girl star. So there can't be a big act, you know, a big actor attached. You know, so there's, you just start learning all the challenges, and then you start trying to think what could I make that means something that I love, that I care about, but it might actually get made. So it's like a balancing act, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot to consider. It's not just what you personally are hoping to do or whatever you're hoping to do with the team you have. It's the age of the actors, whether or not it's going to get funding, whether how long it's going to take. There's a lot that has to go into the decision to make a feature film or a series because there are barriers along the way. Maria, your film, Vida, is going to be screening at the Cascadia Film Festival on Friday. Vida is set in kind of a post-apocalyptic future after a civil war. In the movie, women of color are captured and sterilized as a form of population control. Let's listen to a short clip.
What does this new life look like?
What do you mean?
What are we running to?
Freedom.
A new home.
Songs are together.
It's a serious premise, but the movie is action-packed. Where did you get the inspiration for Vida?
It's a combination of, one, I always wanted to take up space in the action world because it's not a place where we're normally invited to, especially as women. But more importantly, it was inspired by the many women of color who have been forcibly sterilized without their consent. And more specifically, it was inspired by the women in Georgia who were being held in an ICE detention center in 2021. Wow. So I wanted to tell a story that gave women agency over their own bodies, that showed them in all their strength and power. I didn't think it was a time and place to tell a trauma story, although I do think that that story deserves to be told. I just didn't think, you know, during the pandemic and when the world being so heavy, it was not the time and the place to tell that story. And it was more of, I wanted to show female empowerment.
Male directors pretty much dominate the action genre. Did you get any kind of pushback to your idea?
I did. It was people told me, oh, it's too big of a concept for a short film, because I have, you know, three action scenes within the short film. But again, it was more of like, no one is going to give me the opportunity to do an action film, so I'm going to give it to myself. And again, just to take space in a place where we're not invited to, and to show that, yes, we can do it. You know, I don't need permission. I'm going to, you know, give myself the green light to do this. And, you know, that kind of, I've always been a big fan of that genre, but I wanted to do it in a place where we saw women doing it and women not being, damsels in distress. I wanted to show them heroes of their own stories. So,
Jessica, you're a documentary filmmaker based here in Washington. Your new documentary, Call of the Orcas, is about the effort to recover endangered southern resident killer whales through the perspective of killer whale researcher Ken Balcom. It's also going to be screening at the Cascadia Film Festival this weekend. Let's take a listen to a short clip.
Our lives are so intertwined.
Whatever affects us affects them.
Documentary filmmaking involves a different process than making a feature or short narrative film. But is there anything about Catherine and Maria's experiences so far that resonate with you?
Certainly. Absolutely. I mean, first of all, hats off to the huge body of work that Catherine has created. I'm in awe, Catherine. And Maria, I love how you just spoke about taking up space in a genre where we are not widely represented. I think that in both cases, I know certainly documentary exists in a somewhat different world, but I am well aware that we all face challenges just finding the resources to get things made. And as both were describing, assessing a story around those considerations, as well as through the lens of what it is we really want to explore.
Catherine, you're the honored guest director at this year's Cascadia Film Festival, and they're going to be screening your 2015 movie, Miss You Already, starring Toni Collette and Drew Barrymore.
I did it. I got you home.
You are a terrible driver.
In you go.
All right. I miss you already.
Miss you already.
What drew you to this project?
It's a beautiful story of friendship between two women, and you get to watch the joy of their lives together with one of them has kids, the other is trying to have kids. And then you see, not to spoil it, but, you know, Tony's character gets cancer. And so you see how the friendship mutates and changes and how she goes through this with the family. And so it's just a great story about two friends and how much that can sustain you through your life. So getting to do a movie with two wonderful women, Drew and Tony, and, you know, a woman wrote it, Morena Banks. So, you know, it was in London, too. So that was kind of fun.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana Opong in for Libby Denkman. I'm talking to directors Catherine Hardwick, Maria Valdez, and Jessica Plum about their creative work and the film industry. They'll each be screening a film at the Cascadia International Women's Festival in Bellingham this weekend. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll dig into the gender disparity within directing and what can be done about it. Welcome back to Soundside. I'm Diana Opong in for Libby Denkman. Hollywood directors like Patty Jenkins, Ava DuVernay, and Greta Gerwig have found critical and box office success in recent years, breaking through what some have dubbed Hollywood's celluloid ceiling. Yet women still remain dramatically underrepresented as film directors. Let's get back to my conversation with directors Catherine Hardwick, Maria Valdez, and Jessica Plum about their experiences in the film industry. Their works are part of the Cascadia International Women's Film Festival, one of the few festivals in the country dedicated to female creators. It's happening this weekend in Bellingham. I already mentioned a pretty jarringly low percentage of female directors behind the top 250 top grossing films of 2023. Inroads to address this disparity have been made, and we'll get to them in a bit. But I'm curious to hear from all of you. When have you felt this gender disparity the most in your career? Is it when you're on set? Is it when you're pitching to studios or maybe at film festivals? Maria, we'll start with you and then to Catherine.
Yes, thank you. You know, as you mentioned, a lot of the recent surveys seem to point that we're actually moving backwards. So that's very disheartening. And we do feel, you know, there's still a lot of isms. There's still a lot of racism, sexism, ageism, nepotism, we get it all. And I think the only thing that we can do is, you know, create projects for ourselves. And also when we're hiring, to be conscious of who we're hiring. Like I sought out a female DP and a producer, a female producer and a female. So all my top people were women, because we need to give each other opportunities, because the doors are still pretty tight and still hard to walk through, even if we have success. And we still have to fight for space in these places. When they look at us, they see women and women of color, they think, oh, she got here because of, you know, some program, or she got here because somebody gave her an opportunity and she's not qualified. And the truth is that we have to work, you know, 10 times harder. We have to be 10 times more qualified. And so we show up to the table prepared, unlike, you know, our male counterparts that, and not, obviously not, that's a generalization, but not all of them, but you know, we are prepared and we are ready to be in the spaces that we're in. If we're already, you know, if we're hired, we've already been vetted, and more probably than our male counterparts. So we deserve to be in these spaces. So I would say, you know, just keep creating our own projects and keep hiring ourselves and keep hiring more women to be in these places.
Maria, do you have a specific example of a time when you maybe didn't feel like someone saw you as prepared and that you felt like you had to prove yourself more than a colleague or a fellow counterpart?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, certainly. When I, you know, I used to, you know, I started off as a production manager for major television shows. And when I would walk in a room, they wouldn't address me. And, you know, I often had male PAs. They would look at the PA and ask them for questions, or they would go above my head and ask my boss and say, hey, you know, I need you to answer these questions. And inevitably, they would always turn to me because my bosses never had the answers and I was running the show. And they eventually gave me the respect, but I had to, you know, earn it again and again and again to prove myself that I was worthy of already being in a place where I was hired and vetted to be in. And that happened constantly.
Catherine, what about for you? Where do you think you have noticed the gender disparity most in your career?
Well, definitely there's times, even after Twilight was very successful, that I would want to, interview for a job. And one in particular, it had a lot of action in it. And we talked about action space. And people are like, well, a woman can't direct action. I'm like, what the hell? First of all, Twilight did win the best action sequence that year at the MTV Awards. And Lord of the Dogtown's all action. And Kathryn Bigelow's done tons of great action. But why do we have to keep proving it over and over? Of course we can. If that's what you love, if that's what Maria loves, you know, I'm sure you did what I did. Let's study every cool action movie, figure out, test things out and make it awesome. You know, collaborate with your stunt coordinator, which there's a lot of great female stunt coordinators now too. So that's finally breaking through. But I also noticed one thing, and this talks a little bit about, I'm doing a class, like a little whatever master's class at the festival. It's called Fix It in Prep. So what Maria said, encourage anybody to come, because I'll show every little trick that I've learned from other directors when I used to be a production designer, and what I've done on all these different movies, different techniques to really be prepared to direct that action sequence in only a day or only in half a day. And all of these things, I did one movie directed in Italy, one in Morocco, and one in England. And not everybody there is very friendly to female directors at that time. And so I was so prepared, though. I would walk in, stand right where at the beginning of the day, get there half an hour early, stand right where I wanted the first shot. And I had my shot list, storyboards, everything laid out. And so everybody that came in that was thinking, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Who is this? You know, you're used to hearing that kind of crosstalk with the crews, and they, you know, like to talk or whatever. So they couldn't do that really, because I was right there. I was so freaking organized. If I saw the sound cart come in, I go, put it back here because we're looking this way now. And I was just 50 times more organized than all these back talkers could be. So they just had to listen and then realize, oh, she did have a plan for shooting. We made our days. We didn't do any overtime. And you're right. You have to be more prepared than everybody else.
And Jessica, lastly to you, where have you experienced the most sort of disparity in your career when it comes to creating based specifically just on your gender?
Honestly, I would say it's hard to pick the place where I could say I've felt it the most. I think I've experienced it pretty much at every stage of a production, all the way from that early stage of pitching ideas and trying to raise funds to the distribution end. And I will say that in particular, in the world where I've spent the most time, which is really the environmental science and wildlife documentary filmmaking world, we are even more outnumbered. It reminds me, actually, it makes me smile listening to the two of you talk about action. I feel like in some ways the corollary to the action genre in the documentary world is that kind of wildlife science and environmental world. And I mean, I can give the most simple of examples. I was at a film festival that will not be named, one of many in this realm. There are plenty to choose from. And I was looking for another filmmaker for a certain reason. Someone I hadn't met, and this person that I was looking for, you know, I didn't know what he looked like. And I was told, okay, well, just look for so-and-so. He's a guy, 30-something, in a trucker hat, probably wearing a plaid shirt, a little bit of a beard. And I stood up on this balcony over a room full of maybe 200 filmmakers gathering for an opening night party gala type thing. And I scanned the room and I thought, I'm never going to find this guy. It's like, where's Waldo? Like, that's the description that matches like 75% of the room. And as I stood there, I never, by the way, found the person I was looking for. But I made a decision on the balcony. And my decision was I was going to go down and introduce myself literally to every woman in the room and every person of color in the room. And even setting myself both of those assignments, the list was actually really short. And I stood up there and scanned and thought, okay, here's where I'm going to go. I'm going to go and talk to each one of these folks. And there were less than a dozen to talk to in that particular event. I was flabbergasted because the stories that I've taken up and the films that I make are absolutely about topics that are of profound relevance also, regardless of gender, and sometimes specifically for women. They're also topics that, and much of my work has been with our Indigenous communities all surrounding us here in the Pacific Northwest. There were so few people there in that space speaking about those topics from those perspectives. And I have also had the same feeling. I think the other place where I felt most challenged, quite honestly, is navigating relationships with executive producers. We need executive producers in the documentary world, in part to help us shake the money tree, right? And I've had the pleasure of working with lots of wonderful folks. I will say that. I'm trying to think. I've had one female executive producer who really was new on the job in the 20 plus years I've done this. And I have many times found myself feeling that I needed to take an ethical or personal stand, in part for other female characters, that was going to put me at odds with an older and male executive producer. Without going into too much detail, I had one example of that on a commission science-related film I was making, where I was featuring, among others, an emerging lovely young scientist working in a tribal community. And I was on a Zoom call like this with an executive producer literally halfway around the world in London. And this executive producer was asking me to set up a scene that was in no way true to this young woman's experience or even the experience of her tribal community. And I kind of took a deep breath and was like, I'm just going to push back. I'm going to push back right now, and not disrespectfully, but I'm ready to get fired and lose this gig. And so I kind of took a deep breath and said, you know, I hear what you're looking for. I can't set up that scene because that isn't true to this person. And this isn't, you know, a hired actress. This is somebody who's a member of a community that doesn't interact in the environment the way you're suggesting. If what you're asking me to do is to find a way to show her relationship to this landscape in a way that's true to her in a brief scene that sets up the following scenes, I would be glad to propose that, and I'll do it. But I'm not going to do what you're asking me to do. And there was this kind of long silence, and I looked around like this. And unlike the situation, I was the only woman in the Zoom, right? I was also the only woman on the West Coast. I was also the only person, like, not in a major urban area funding these projects. And I'm happy to report that at that time, actually, my proposal was accepted. And I was told, okay, come back to me in like 48 hours with a proposal for a scene that does what you think it will do. And this was another short film, and I did it, and I'm happy with the result. But I've been in a lot of those moments where I wasn't sure whether I should draw the line and where I should stand.
I appreciate all of those insights. It's really helpful to hear what you each have experienced in different areas and the challenges that you've faced and sort of what you've seen in the industry just over your time creating in this space. Catherine and Maria, the forecast for the business of Hollywood is looking kind of stormy. The money's not flowing like it used to. Many studios are on rocky financial footing. And there's a lot of reason behind this, including the economics of streaming and whether it actually supports the full cost of making projects. But overall, studios are expected to produce fewer scripted shows in 2024. It's possible studios could try to weather this period by being more selective with their projects that they greenlight, which could also mean fewer opportunities for up-and-coming directors and directors from more diverse backgrounds. Known IP and directors with hits already under their belts will be safer financial bets for a lot of these studios. What concerns, if any, do you have about the future of the industry right now? Catherine, we'll start with you.
Yes, I think it is kind of a scary time. It's a rocky time. And we keep hearing on all the different Zooms and meetings that it's a tough time. Companies are shrinking. So we have less executives, as I mentioned before, you know, whatever, different streamers. The people get fired, their job stability, it's crazy. So how can we do maybe what Maria says, try to find a way to make projects that you can green light yourself? Or can you make short films that don't require so much money? Are there other alternatives to having to be in the machine, in the business of Hollywood? Are there still people that will finance indie films? You know, those are all those challenges that we have to look for other ways to do things, because I do think it's getting more challenging. It was always hard to get a movie made or a TV series made. Now it's even 10 times harder. So, yeah. And the spotlight, we had that spotlight on women for a while. And that's how I got hired on some shows. I think, you know, like on This Is Us, they probably needed more women. So, you know, I got to direct a couple episodes or this one. But now, you know, things are getting tighter. There's less to do out there. So it's kind of scary.
What about for you, Maria? Are you concerned about the future of your ability to create in this space and also consume other creatives' work?
Yeah, I mean, it is indeed a scary time, but I mean, this business has always been a roller coaster. It has, you know, it's ups and downs. But, you know, having gone through the pandemic and the strike, it feels a little unstable. But I think for me, the way I look at it as an opportunity. It's an opportunity to keep developing, to keep writing. It's definitely a time to do that and to spend time with your stories and decide what stories you really want to tell. Because it will come back up. And when it does come back up, you want to be as prepared as, you know, humanly possible. So it's for me, it's staying in the development stage and writing and, you know, just, yeah, writing is what you can do right now. So when the doors, you know, come back up and the roller coaster does come back up that hill, you're prepared. And also, you know, just to keep honing my skills and, you know, in every part of this industry. You know, as women, we're multitaskers. We don't sit around. Yeah, just keep working on your craft and keep developing. I think that's what's going to keep us afloat and keep us prepared when, you know, the wave does come over.
Before we go, I want to ask about everybody's experience at film festivals, because it's a big part of being a filmmaker. It can help with getting your film distributed. It's also an opportunity to meet other directors and filmmakers. Cascadia is unique in that it's one of just a handful of film festivals here in the U.S. that's solely focused on featuring the work of female filmmakers. It's also unlike other film festivals in that there aren't any awards given out. For you, how does all of that impact your experience in sharing your work? We'll start with Catherine.
Well, I have had beautiful experiences at film festivals, you know, like my first one, you know, I got to take 13 to Sundance. So that was amazing. And it's amazing to have your film screened in a theater and with an audience that wants to be there and is excited. And, you know, you get to talk to all these other, I can't wait to meet you guys in person and, you know, talk to all these other filmmakers that are coming at it from their own perspectives. So I've met, you know, many people that I love and have stayed in touch with over the years at film festivals. And I'm really looking forward to this one too.
Wonderful. Jessica, and then to Maria.
Well, likewise, I just want to second that it's a wonderful opportunity to connect with fellow filmmakers. And there really are so, so few film festivals that are devoted to female directors. I feel incredibly fortunate that we have a great one in what's my backyard anyway. And it's a really different type of festival than anything else that many of us do. I feel that as a documentary filmmaker, film festivals are really, for many of us, launch pads for projects that otherwise might not get traction or be seen at all. And in this particular case, it's a short project, but certainly with the experience of my first feature, it wouldn't exist if film festivals, it wouldn't have seen the rest of the world if film festivals hadn't taken a chance on it.
And Maria, what are you looking forward to, and what are the things that you love most about film festivals?
Well, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful to have a space to showcase my work. And, you know, it never gets old seeing your film on a big screen. It's a dream realized. I mean, you know, as a kid, I always wanted to be in the movie business, and never thought I would actually see my film on a big screen. So that is, you know, a bucket list dream. But I think that the biggest thing that I've gotten out of the festival is the friendships that I've developed. You know, every festival that I go to, I meet such a wonderful group of filmmakers that have now become, you know, like lifelong friends. And that's probably the most important thing that I've gotten out of the festival is the relationships. And they're just great fun. It, you know, you meet a lot of filmmakers, you watch a lot of great movies, a great experience. So, yeah, super grateful to be here.
Maria Valdez is a Guatemalan-born, California-raised narrative director. Her new film is Vida. Jessica Plum is a Port Townsend-based documentary director and producer. Her new documentary is Call of the Orcas. And Catherine Hardwick is the director of the movie Miss You Already, 13, and of course, Twilight. Maria, Jessica, Catherine, thank you all so much for being here and sharing your stories.
Thank you for having us.
Honor.
And if you want to check out the Cascadia International Women's Film Festival, you can find ticket information at cascadiafilmfest.org.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.